You're listening to Dr. Marina Kurian on Doctor Radio, Sirius XM 81.
All right, you guys, we are back. And as promised, we're going to talk about organ donation this next hour. And joining me to help make this conversation happen, interesting, Dr. David O'Connor is with me, CRNA, DNAP. We're going to continue our discussion. He has some experience with organ harvesting, as do I, as a surgeon and as an anesthesia provider. But we're talking about organ donation with Stu Strumwasser, who's the author of the medical thriller, The Organ Broker. And it was interesting because last night I was I didn't read the whole book, okay? I'm going to just tell you right now, Stu.
That's the disclaimer.
However, I read a significant part of this book, and it is extremely well written. And I mean, I'm just so proud of you.
Oh, thanks.
Well, you know, you're a charming fella, and you have quite the way with words. And I did not realize that you can also, in written prose, if you will, put that down. It's really well written. It's a great read. I don't think I spoke to Dave for about an hour as I was reading it.
I forgot she was even there.
Yeah,
she was so quiet.
It was almost. I don't want to give everybody the idea that it's like Dan Brown, okay? But it is so well written that you just sit and read.
Well, you.
I don't know if that's my personality though, but I'm just saying. I think that it was just that well written and very interesting and really great character portrayals.
That's awesome. Thank you. I think you know me as a songwriter. But for me, the experience of writing a song or writing fiction, which I've been doing, you know, both of them for my whole life, is really quite similar.
I thought the fiction part was all the stories that you would tell us, but now I know. I'm just kidding.
No, so sometimes I write them down.
Right. So Stu and I have known each other for years, actually through my husband Dave, because they played in bands simultaneously and also together, and they have played together. With Dave filling in as the bass player and Stu being the singer and occasionally the drummer, depending on the situation. But when he wrote this book, it immediately piqued my interest, mainly because he's talking about organ donation. And I went to the book reading and I thought, you know what, you have to come on my show. I have done shows on organ donation and heard wonderful stories. People call in talking about, you know, the life that they've been that they or their loved one have been given because of a donation. And one of the months, I'm blanking on which month it is National Organ. It just happened. It was April, May. You can talk. It's all right. You can interrupt my...
I was trying to give you an assist.
Oh, I don't lip read that well.
No, April was National Organ Donation Awareness Month. And actually, April 17th is called Blue-Green Day. Which is kind of the single day of the year when some of these nonprofits, you know, kind of circle around to create the greatest awareness. And it was interesting because I was actually at an event that day with an author named Lisa Scatolini, who's very popular. She has a huge audience. I was down on a panel with her in Florida on that very day, and we got to talk about it with an audience. And because it was a huge audience, 300-400 people packed into an auditorium at a library, and because the audience was primarily elderly, you know, when we got into that little, you know, side note about the Organ Donation Awareness Month and the fact that it was Blue-Green Day, it clearly resonated with them. And I think we'll talk about this today, but, you know, so much of this issue is related to the aging of America and also obesity, you know, because that's kind of where this chain of events starts that leads to diabetes, end-stage renal disease, people needing a kidney, which is 80% of the waiting list for organs.
Yes, it is. Okay, so... just to give a shout out now to the website, it's www.theorganbroker.com. But it's interesting to me because you actually, rightfully so, did a lot of research for this book before you. I mean, it's fiction, but I was asking my daughter, I'm like, what kind of fiction is it when it's like based on real stuff? She's like, it's called realistic fiction. And I was like, oh. Okay, I'm definitely going to use that because how would I know that? I didn't know. But she told me.
I think that's a school term. My kids are 10 and in fifth grade, and I hear them talk that way too.
Yeah. Or you mean that tone of voice? Or
no,
you mean
the term realist. Oh, I get that tone of voice daily.
It's no, and then she was like, "I don't talk like that." I'm like, "I know you probably don't. I just love to imitate you talking like that because I think it's so funny." Anyway, so I told her I was going to bring that up because it is realistic fiction. You had to do a lot of research, and so tell me, what is an organ broker?
Okay, so an organ broker, excuse me, is a guy who, you know, is involved in selling organs illegally in the black market. Like anything else, you know, drugs, alcohol during prohibition, the minute you make something illegal, instantly there's a black market because somebody can make money selling it illicitly. So in the mid-80s, I think it was 86, give or take a year, NOTA was passed in the United States, the National Organ Transplantation Act. And it specified a variety of things related to organ donation, organ transplantation. It was just becoming really medically possible with the invention of immunosuppressant drugs. And they made it illegal to receive, quote, anything of value for an organ. In the ensuing handful of years, it was adopted in some form or another by almost every single country on the planet. Interestingly, notably, the only country where it's not illegal to get paid to sell an organ is Iran, and I don't know why or necessarily whether that's a good or a bad thing. But the black market, as it, you know, kind of takes place around the world, it, you know, is more of what is now called transplant tourism. And Jack, New York Jack, the character in my book, is a transplant tourism director. And there's not too many of these guys, but they do exist, and they hook up with wealthy Americans, Europeans who need an organ, typically it's a kidney, and rather than waiting what is now 7 years on a waiting list for a kidney where about 18 people a day die while waiting, for around $150,000, if you find yourself a transplant tourism director, you can go to a hospital transplant center that's on the take in some third world country, whether it be somewhere in Asia or the former Soviet Union, South America, and you can buy yourself new health.
You met an organ broker.
I did.
More than one?
I've only met one guy in person who was exactly a transplant tourism director. And I have to tell you, it was the most fascinating 2 hours of my life. The crazy thing is that as Dave is sitting here, Mika, a former bandmate of mine who lived in L.A., like came to me with me to this lunch, which was about now 6-7 years ago. And I connected with this guy on the internet, and he is a transplant tourism director, and he sends wealthy Americans overseas to buy organs that they life-saving organs that they need. His stories were incredible. I have no idea how much of it was true, how much of it was not true, but I have no reason to doubt his veracity. And I can also tell you that I don't know if this is typical, but this guy was kind of crazy. And it was an incredible lunch. And it kind of morphed from talking about the black market for organs, which I was most interested in, into his, you know, research. And he told me that, you know, I said, how many of these do you do? Are you really busy? Do you make a ton of money? And he said, you know, over the last few years, I've really focused a lot more on my research. And I said to him, I was like, you know, well, are you a physician or a scientist? I didn't realize that. And he goes, yeah, well, I don't have a degree or anything, but for the last few years, I've been pouring most of my energy into researching how to use human growth hormone to extend life. And I've been injecting myself daily, and I think I've now gotten it to an equilibrium where I am going to live forever.
So. Okay. So that should have been note to self right there. But that is that's interesting. But I want to come back to the organ donation part because, you know, currently if you have kidney disease and kidney failure, I'm going to go with kidney failure because the liver stuff can happen really rapidly. But certainly the heart stuff also, which you write about in your book, cardiomyopathy and people getting on because they have heart failure, getting on a transplant list is a big deal. And actually for hearts, there's probably more people dying percentage-wise on that list than are getting hearts, kidney?
Actually, I don't think that's true.
Yeah.
Although, depending on the way that you're breaking it down, I'm not sure. Let me give you a couple of just kind of general statistics. I don't profess to be a medical expert, but I, as you said, I did some research. So as I was telling your producer, I've had this idea about this guy. You know, I find the black market fascinating. But for me, the fascination was always much more about who's this guy, you know, than it was organ transplantation or the black market per se. I always thought it was incredibly interesting when I started reading stories about this in the late 80s and the 90s. You know, like, who is the guy who becomes a black market organ broker? Why? Who is this guy? And his story would be fascinating. And it was always on my mind.
But, you know, I remember back in the day, and to all my New Orleans folks, you know, I'm sorry, it is urban legend, that, you know, people would wake up, you know, all of a sudden right. in an alley. And
in
they
a bathtub
had like,
of ice.
Yeah, or they had like a cut and they didn't
so
know.
That's not
they
true.
Were disoriented. That never happened.
Never.
No one's like lifted off the streets
no.
of New York. You know, there are a lot of TV shows that talk about that,
They
too.
Do, and it's completely incorrect.
It's all, see, urban...
Yeah.
Urban lore.
So that is totally an urban myth. And there's an example of some guys who didn't do the research. And this is why. I'm not saying that that's never happened. You know, the rumors about kidney thieves, I think the most popular version, and it's alluded to in passing in my book. I think the most popular version is like the drunk businessman in Las Vegas who picks up some girl, goes to a hotel room, she slips him a Mickey. Or roofie or whatever, and he wakes up in a bathtub of ice with a note that says, get to a hospital or you're going to die. Here's the thing. You know, nobody would ever do that. Even criminals aren't necessarily crazy, because why would you take the risk of committing kidnapping, attempted murder, and a variety of other felonies when you could just buy one from somebody poor in a third world country for what equates to about $1,000? It just doesn't really happen. But let me complete the thought and go back and tell you in terms of how big a problem this is. When I started writing this book, when the idea kind of crystallized for me, and we could talk about this. I think we have time, but I'll come back to it. I was at a wedding in Costa Rica on the beach, and at 3 a.m. with a couple too many scotches in me, it all of a sudden hit me. I know how to write this story that's always been in my mind. And we could talk about that more if you want, but let me... get to the point about the black market, how big a problem this is. At the time when I started first researching this, it was 2008, there were around 90,000 people on the waiting list for organs in the United States. Today, my book was published a couple of weeks ago, just 7 years later, that waiting list has ballooned to 124,000 people. That's an increase of about 35%. 80% of those people, roughly, are waiting for kidneys, which, as we know, are redundant. You don't need necessarily two of them, but there's an extremely inefficient access to organs. Livers comprise about another 15% of the list. So about 95% of the people on that waiting list could be helped with a living donation, or, you know, with a donation from someone who ends up brain dead in a hospital. And unfortunately, there's a variety of points in the chain between donor and recipient where it's broken, and those organs that could be saving lives are lost or end up in the garbage. Just to respond to what you're saying about cardiomyopathy, the list for hearts is very short. There's only a couple thousand, 1,000, 3,000, I don't know the exact number. And those people, as you can imagine, very, very sick. They typically end up either at home on bed rest, on alert, that they have to be ready at any time should a heart come in, or even they end up in a hospital, as particularly if it's, you know, final stage cardiomyopathy, heart failure, where sometimes they're kept up on an LVAD, which kind of keeps the heart.
So LVAD, you know, is a left ventricular assist device.
Yeah, and that's even mentioned in my book. What happens is this guy who's essentially a kidney broker ends up with a crisis of conscience, where as he is, like, his guilt and his conflicts are escalating right at the time when somebody tells him that they'll pay him a $2 million commission to get a heart. And, of course,
there's only one way to get a heart.
There's only one way to get a heart. Right.
So, just for our listeners, because as I said, it's just a fascinating. It's a fascinating book. You know, it's based on facts and some creative writing. I mean, well written, not creative like fantastical. You know what I'm saying? Because Stu's giving me like a look, like what's happening here. But anyway, I want to say that during my training, and certainly, you know, here at NYU, and there's Columbia, there's Cornell, there's Mount Sinai, there are several different transplant programs in the city where the transplant surgeons work closely with basically the network, the UNOS, to get organs. And there are ways that patients get to the top of the list if something comes up. But when I was training, which is where I had the most experience with this, if you heard of a kidney that had, and basically everybody in the program has their blood type, their other antigen match, the HLA match, everything is up in a national system. So if a kidney becomes available that matches that patient, it will, the patient will be called, the doctor will be called, the patient can't have a cold, the patient has to be in 100%, you know, as healthy as they can be, considering that they have, you know, end-stage renal disease or other issues. So they have to be in an optimum condition to receive a transplant. And then, and invariably, this happens at night, right? This is always happening at night. And the, you know, the team stays to get the kidney, to prepare the patient. And this is for cadaveric transplants, meaning that someone became brain dead and they were an organ donor, which is why, you know, in April, everybody was like, you know, become an organ donor, sign the card, sign up online or do it on your license. Although nowadays our licenses are such you can't write on them anymore, but you can certainly go online and register to be an organ donor. And these patients would be ready to go in the middle of the night. Now, there's also living-related transplant, where I have had patients, I had a patient give his kidney to his dad. I've had other patients who have received kidneys from family members, but not necessarily, I mean, that was the first time I heard of the son donating to the dad. But that also happens. And wasn't there a story about a couple who had another daughter so that their older daughter could have a bone marrow transplant? That was a real story. That's not, I didn't make that.
No, that.
That's not part of your book.
It's not. No.
No.
So
I just wanted to explain to the population how this whole works. And I think that it is important to be an organ donor just because there are so many people who are waiting. But your point really that you brought up when you did this reading is that you are really. No, when you did the reading before.
He was talking about living forever, that other guy.
Yeah, we're done with that guy. It is that you don't like the current system in this country. Think it's flawed.
Right. That's why I wanted to ask, you know, so what if you check the box on the back of your license? What are the chances you're not going to, you know, ultimately wind up in, and only because I've seen this happen, you have a family member or, you know, so you for some reason become brain dead, and then there's this, you know, the time is ticking. You don't have a lot of time, and what are the chances that kidney is really going to wind up helping somebody?
There's also myths. You got to handle both of us. You can do it. You're from New York. Yeah.
Not a problem.
Yeah. So there's myths like if I check the box, they're not going to actually take care of me, which is ridiculous.
Crazy.
We would never.
No,
they're like, okay, there are seven, eight people that could benefit from your body, so we're just not going to take care of you. You're done. We're just going to donate. We don't do that.
Well, I'm hearing a bunch of questions, so let me try to respond to some of them. So about the myth. Marina's question always comes before yours.
I'm the host.
So of course, no doctor or hospital in their right minds would ever withhold care from someone so that they could get an organ donation from them. And this is a problematic misconception. A lot of people do have that fear, and I think it's you know.
Okay, I'm going to be honest. I said it before too.
Yeah.
I always think, like Dave knows, my kids know, I'm an organ donor.
Mm-hmm.
I've never checked the box because I think I'm going to die. Silly things. I think that, yeah, I know.
I don't follow what you're saying. You're an organ donor, but you have not checked the box?
I haven't checked the box.
How are you an organ donor?
They all know. I've told them. This is my proxy.
Oh,
right there.
I see. Okay, yeah, not good enough. So
yeah,
we're gonna
pressure me into it.
We're gonna fix that today. So for your listeners, when they're done going,
even doctors have crazy like little.
I'm so glad you said this.
Well, that's okay. I'm honest about my craziness.
I'm really glad you said it because this is something that we can address right now, right? Because you have billions and billions of people around the world listening to us right now, and I think it's really important. Well, first of all, I'd love your listeners to please go to Amazon, search The Organ Broker, and buy my book. And then when they're done doing that, if they could take 30 seconds and go to donatelife.net, register to be an organ donor. It takes a minute or two. Let me clear up a couple of myths and be really direct about this. You have to remember, in America, it's always about money. And as human beings, we're often very self-interested. No doctor, no hospital is going to risk his entire life, 42 malpractice suits, and going to jail to end up procuring an organ for a stranger. It's insane. It would never, ever, ever happen, right? When you register to be an organ donor, there's an enormous chance that it will remain irrelevant throughout the entire life, your entire life and death. But what happens is this. A very, very small portion of us end up having a car accident or something goes wrong. And about 15,000 Americans end up brain dead every year. Marina is absolutely correct. And that's where the vast majority of organ donations come from. They're harvested from. Now, the problem, there's two problems with the system. And Dave was asking the question that is really the most important question to me. I mean, by the way, let me just say this for your audience. I want to be honest, too. I'm here to sell books. I wrote a novel. It's a cool, exciting, thrilling story about this guy. But what happened for me was that I learned some stuff along the way, and I became very genuinely upset and concerned and angry.
It's your passion about the topic that is really, you know, one of the reasons I had you come on, not because you just wrote a book and I know you.
Yeah, well, thanks.
It's your passion about what we need to do to move forward.
Yes, and what's crazy about this problem is, you know, there's so many problems in the world, and where the rubber hits the road is that it's like, okay, we have this problem that we want to fix. We want to build a bridge or help some poor people, whatever it might be. And then the question again, as I said a moment ago, in America, it's often about money in the world, right? We live in the real world. And then the question often becomes, all right, well, how are we going to pay for this? And then you have this push and pull between, okay, we want to do something, but how do you fund it, right? So the crazy thing about this problem is that as we sit here today in this lovely, comfortable office here in the lobby at NYU Langone Medical Center, as we're talking right now, someone's going to die. Because an organ wasn't donated in time. But between the time I got here and the time I leave, somebody's going to die. There's going to be 21 people that die today and then 21 more tomorrow. And nobody's watching. Nobody seems to care. By the end of the year, if you think about it, around 7,000 Americans will die because an organ wasn't donated in time. That's about twice the number of people that we lost on 9/11. Why is no one paying attention? I don't know. Now, the question is that problem fixable? Well, the crazy, infuriating thing for me and people who are working to try to affect change in this area is that it's entirely fixable. And if we fixed it, it wouldn't cost money. It would save us money. Because anyone who doesn't get a kidney and ends up on dialysis costs Medicare about $250,000 more than they would have cost us if they had gotten a kidney transplant. That money, 85% of the cost of dialysis in America is paid for by Medicare, which means you and you and me in our tax dollars. And the bill right now to Americans is about $10 billion a year to pay for people to get sick and die who could otherwise have been saved. So again, back to Dave's question, which I think is the most critical one. So what's wrong? What's the disconnect? Well, there's two things. You ready? This is how I boil it down, and I think it's simple. Number one, you got to knock it off, and you got to register to be an organ donor. So if you haven't checked the box yet, don't feel bad, but go do it today. Donatelife.net. It takes a minute or two, and then you can feel better about yourself. It's never going to be needed, but in the one in a million chance that it was you, you could literally save eight other people's lives. Here's the numbers. In a famous Gallup poll from about 10 years ago, 95% of Americans said that they approve of organ donation. Can you imagine anything that 95% of Americans agree on? People often ask me, what about religious, perspective? Pope John Paul II personally and explicitly said that donating an organ to someone is one of the most Christian things that one could do. It's very much in step with the ideas of Jesus. So I think that you have it clear that most people approve of this idea, and yet only 45% of us bother to actually check the box. Some, like Marina, have, you know, some crazy, you know, fear, or some, you know, many of us, it's just we didn't bother. So instead of feeling bad or worrying about yesterday, let's just fix it. Let's get more people to register. But then, to Dave's point more specifically, the real problem is not registration. It's what those in the business of trying to fix this problem call conversion. So as we just explained, most of these organs come from people who end up brain dead in a hospital. It's about 15,000 Americans. And as Dave said, the chain of events is that when your loved one has a car accident, ends up brain dead in a hospital, someone from that hospital who may be perfectly trained and experienced or may be imperfectly trained and experienced is now going to approach that family at the very worst time. That is completely unanticipated, because an hour ago, your husband, your son, your wife was fine, but now she's about to die. And now someone is going to say to you, listen, there's nothing we can do. She's a goner. We want to harvest her organs. Is that okay? And about half the families that are asked say no.
Right. Now, it's a tough time.
Some of those people step up and do the right thing, and they say, look, if there's really nothing... Let's be clear. When someone is brain dead, there's a 0% chance of recovery. Some of those people step up and they say, if she's really gone and there's absolutely zero chance of recovery, let's go help some other people. Many of them, whether it was selfish or they're just so distraught, they say no. Now here's the crazy part. Some of the people we're talking about were not organ donors. Some were. And what happens is the hospital, again, because they're more worried about money and malpractice suits and bad publicity, there's almost no OPO, organ procurement organization, in America that will overrule the wishes of the family. And this is where my view on this gets kind of radical, and I don't know what's radical about it, right? Here's how I explain it to people. I'm 49. I have two 10-year-old sons. If something happened to me tomorrow and I died, is somebody from a hospital or a lawyer's office or the local clown college, you know, going to come out and say to my sons, listen, really sorry, dad's dead. Now, he had a will, and in the will, he said, you don't get the money till you're 30. Do you want us to honor the will, or should we just cut you a check right now? I mean, of course, that seems crazy to us, right? Like, I am entitled to determine the disposition of my money after death. Why am I not entitled to determine the disposition of my own body? I mean, we should be. And the crazy thing is that right now in most states where there's organ donor registration at the DMV, which is the vast majority of states, right, in the majority of those, it is legally binding. And yet they ask the family. If the family says no, they don't overrule them. And the victim's wishes go right out the window, and they are supplanted by those of their family who may be thinking clearly and may just be distraught and confused and really upset, and they don't even know what they're saying, and you need to go to commercial. No, there are no commercials.
No, hold on. No, we do. We do have to go to break, but I want to take a phone call. Marlene is calling from Mississippi. And by the way, you guys who are listening, who, you know, again, the time has just flown by, probably not because I was talking, but because Stu was talking. You can give us a call at 877-NYU-DOCS, 877-698-3627, or email us, docs@SiriusXM.com, if you want to join the conversation about organ donation, or if you have questions for us, you can certainly give us a call. Marlene, welcome to Dr. Radio. What is your question or comment for us?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment. I donated a kidney to my grandson. He was 5 years of age at the time, and I was 53. So age did not play into that. And I would just like to encourage everyone to consider organ donation, no matter what your age. A living kidney is wonderful, and so I would just like to encourage everyone to consider organ donation. It was a marvelous thing. I'm doing well. My grandson is doing well, and just everyone consider donating.
Thank you, Marlene. That's great.
Can I respond to Marlene? I want her to stay on the phone for a minute, please. Marlene, that's such an awesome, wonderful story. You know, as a dad of two little boys, Marina and Dave, who are sitting in front of me, have two little kids that I know since they're born. What a touching story, right? So let me tell you what an amazing thing Marlene did. I'm constantly asked, am I too old to be an organ donor? About a third of organ donations last year came from people over 50, just like Marlene. The chance of her grandson, who is now, you know, at the time, rather, was 5 years old, living a healthy life with that donated kidney are spectacular. 10, 20 years ago, it might have been that, you know, the view would have been that he's going to need to take, cyclosporine or some immunosuppressant drug to make sure that there's never organ rejection. And that eventually kind of wears down other parts of your system.
Yeah,
including that kidney. And the view might be that in 10, 20 years, he might need another one, depending on how good of a match they were. Marlene, do you happen to know how many HLAs you had matching with your grandson? Does that ring a bell?
No, I'm sorry, it doesn't. I went through all the processing, the medical test, and my glucose level was a little elevated, so I was declined for donation. But I was determined to get it done, so exercised, I watched my diet, I lost about 30 pounds. They reconsidered me and accepted me as a donor.
You're killing me.
This is exactly the thing that he wants to talk about. We're going to have to go to break. Marlene, you are amazing. You are,
as my
producer just texted me, you are her hero. You are our hero. Thank you so much for your donation. I'm sure your family is thrilled. And then not only that, it's about to, like, corral the issues in your own health just to make yourself a better donor is just amazing. So thank you so much. We are going to go to break. When we return, again, Stu Strumwasser, author of The Organ Broker, Dr. David O'Connor, and myself, I'm Marina Kurian. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Is Dr. Radio, Sirius XM 81, and on the Sirius XM app for smartphones.
All right, you guys, we're back. Thank you, Amari, for a little Marvin Gaye. Oh, my gosh, by the way, there's some song that Meghan Trainor's singing where she's talking about Marvin Gaye. She's on the song. I didn't like the lyrics, but I'm just saying. Maybe you know what I'm talking about? No? Anyway, it's some new Marvin Gaye song about it's in the title, Marvin Gaye, but it's not by Marvin Gaye. Interesting. To me, alone. Apparently, the two of you are like, please just get back to it. We are talking about organ donation. And we're doing that with Stu Strumwasser, author of The Organ Broker. Also, Dr. David O'Connor stayed with me for the second hour. I do like the company. And we're going to go take our calls. As I always ask you guys who listen to call, and you always comply. You always comply. You always help me out and give us a call. But if you have questions about organ donation, again, you can give us a call at 877-NYU-DOCS. That's 877-698-3627. Or email us, docs@SiriusXM.com. Brenda from New York, welcome to Dr. Radio.
Hi.
What is your question for us?
Hi. Well, I am currently signed up to donate my body to a local medical university. And I guess I had two questions. One is, and I would be happy to donate any spare parts that the medical students don't need, but I don't know if it's possible. Is it possible to donate both your body and still donate some other parts if needed? And I also wondered if it's more important to just be an organ donor and split up the parts versus donating your body to a medical center.
Well, Brenda, this is excellent because this is a great question. I think personally you should be definitely an organ donor, and that does not preclude you from donating your body to science or to a medical center. So for you guys listening who are like, what are we talking about? This sounds so crazy. It's totally real. We, as medical students, have cadavers that we dissect for anatomy. Actually, my husband also had a cadaver that was cadaveric dissection.
Absolutely.
In anatomy, and they are based on donations of self. So these are people who were like, yeah, I'm going to die at some point, but you can definitely have my body. So, you know, so medical students can dissect and learn about this. It honestly, and not meant in a sick way at all, but I loved anatomy. I loved every bit of what I had to do, what I learned from, you know, my cadaver. I still remember her name. And at the end of that entire, course, you actually go to a funeral for your cadavers, basically, for the people that you train with. You go and they do a burial for them. And it's a big deal. I would hazard a guess that, I don't know about other docs, but everyone that was in my class probably would be able to tell you the name of the person that donated their body so that we could learn. And it's incredible. That is also a great gift. But you can donate your organs as well as do the body donation, mainly because, you know, they just tell you, like, you get, you know, in some part, it's like a mystery. You try to figure out what they died of. So because you have the same cadaver for like weeks on end, right? But then you figure out along the way that, oh, she had her gallbladder out, you know, and then there's a place where you can go and check. And then you figure out what it was that caused the ultimate demise of your cadaver. But sometimes it's just old age. So not having the kidneys in because you donated it, or the heart, not necessarily a big deal at all. We don't do that much heart dissection. And if that were the case, you can actually go to another, another cadaver group and look at the heart dissection. And they also do those kind of dissections as en masse, if you will. And then there are these new programs that are out there that I hadn't used, new computer sims of dissection, and I'm not sure if medical schools actually should ask here first, because we have a great medical school here, NYU School of Medicine. I should ask here if they're doing SIMS more than cadaveric dissections, but you can do both, and you should, if you're willing to give your body to be dissected by medical students, you should definitely do the organ donation. I think that'd be critical.
I want to interject something here. To Stu's point before the break, this is a this is a serious topic. This is a discussion you should have with your loved ones now while you're alive, so that when the time comes, if it's a catastrophic event or something, that your family is at ease with your decision and they're aware of it and they're going to follow through on it.
You know, I can add one thing to that that's really interesting. As I was saying before the break, that the biggest part of the problem is in conversion, not just in registration. A shout out to one nonprofit that I know that's doing a really interesting and creative thing to try to impact that. They're called Organize.org. I know the founders, and their mission is to ask people who register to be organ donors to confirm their wishes on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, so that years or many years later down the road, should there be, you know, a catastrophic, you know, accident, and they end up being the one in a million who is in that position of potentially being able to save eight other people's lives, when that, you know, awkward and difficult moment comes to have that conversation with the family, they can show them, well, not only did he check the box on his driver's license, but here's what he said on Facebook 8 years ago about why it was important to him to do this.
That's great.
Yeah, that is good. I think it's hopefully you think Facebook's going to last that long? I'm just kidding, of course.
It looks like it's here to stay.
I think it might be here to stay, yeah. All right, Brenda, thank you so much for calling in. We're going to David from Pennsylvania. David, welcome to Dr. Radio. What is your question for us?
Hi, I'm 70 years old, and when I was 10 years old, which was 1955, I had infectious hepatitis. Before they knew to give hepatitis letters, I think. And my question is, can I donate organs? Because I know over the years, many times they've told me I couldn't donate blood. But I'm so far away from it now. Is that something I can still do?
I think you should definitely check with your doctor, but it certainly depends on the type of hepatitis you have. If it was A, then absolutely, I believe that you can definitely do it. Hepatitis B, and you recovered, I think you probably can, but they have some rules about it, and they also check for other types. Hepatitis C is more of a difficult one.
My guess, I have something to add on this. My guess is that based on having had liver disease and also being a little older, there's a chance that you might not be an appropriate donor. Interestingly, okay. in the book, it references a patient who needs an organ who has AIDS. And 10, 20 years ago, that would have basically meant there's no way you're getting an organ. Today, that is starting to change, but I think it is part of the problem. We kind of, Dr. Kurian, like mentioned this in passing, and then we kind of veered away from it. But the manner in which organ donors are chosen and matched with recipients is on a hospital-by-hospital basis and is not standardized and is subjective. It's something that personally I take issue with. But those kind of factors all get considered in a subjective evaluation that determines who gets what organ. As Marina said, I think that the fact that you are interested in being an organ donor is certainly commendable.
Is there a cutoff age? Is there?
I don't know.
They look at basically every, and you have to understand, David. I'm not a transplant surgeon, but they're basically looking at your age, your overall kidney function. Before all this happened, like they're kind of risk stratifying your organs and looking at the donation pool and making decisions based on that. And so that's why sometimes, kidneys are turned down in seemingly healthy people for a variety of reasons, whereas you can be in your 80s and 90s and have organs taken. So my producer, Beth, just put out that there is no set age limit. But it does entirely matter what your overall health is going into it. And the type of hepatitis you had will matter. in terms of making a decision, mainly because the reason is you're on immunosuppressive agents, and they tend to suppress everybody's immunity. So if there's a virus that's part of an organ, it can actually flourish when the person that you donated to, their immune system's a little bit depressed. So there are definitely variations on what the criteria are based on the person that is getting the organ. But you should definitely look into it. I think that there are, you know, they do a lot of harvesting. They harvest bone as well. They harvest not just organs like the kidney, the liver, heart, lungs, but there are other things that
they take eyes
for the cornea. So there's a lot of donation possible. So it's just something that if you want to, they evaluate whether you're a candidate. They look at the way, you know, when you die, like how you died, what happened. If you had prolonged low blood pressure, that matters to them. They look at the kidney function. So there are a lot of different things that go into harvesting the organs in patients. And so not everyone that becomes brain death or you know, is going to die is going to be able to donate based on their condition of death. Sounds so macabre and a little bit more morbid, but that is unfortunately the way it's done. They do measure the quality of your organs, basically, for donation. David, thank you so much for calling in. We're going to Bruce from New York. Bruce, welcome to Dr. Radio. What is your question or comment for us?
Hi, good morning. First of all, I just want to thank you so much for the show and taking my call. I just had a question for you. I have basically no family members up here with me, and I'm an organ donor, and I know it's a very time-sensitive thing. Is there a way of, like, having any kind of an ID bracelet saying not to bother trying to contact family because it would be kind of futile? Or, because like I said, I know it's so time-critical for some of the organs.
No, they have to let your family know if they can reach them reasonably, but... I thought also one of the questions, is there a card or something that you can carry that says you're an organ donor that goes in your wallet, or is there a med alert that you can have saying organ donor? Do you know?
I think there is an organ donor card. I should know this.
I actually think that there is because I remember...
I apologize that I don't know this, and I'm going to find out. But I can say that part of the problem is that it's not standardized. Right.
Yeah, and you have to see if it's like a legally binding type of thing, you know?
Well, this is the thing. The entire system is fragmented. It's different from state to state. And UNOS, the kind of the quasi-governmental agency that oversees all of the OPOs, doesn't have really one national registry. And in each state, they operate differently. And at each transplant center or OPO, they have their own lists. So if there is some sort of donor, identification card, it's not a standardized or in any way a binding or formal such item. So I don't know.
I just tried to Google it. Google failed me. But you can sign up at organdonor.gov as well to sign up for your individual state. And there are a bunch of different places. But you said...
That's true.
Organdonation.net is what you said.
No, donatelife.net is that's the largest nonprofit where their mission is all about registration. They're also they have a big initiative right now about living donors and altruistic donors, because of course that's it leads to better outcomes, you know, for recipients and a cadaver kidney. You can sign up at either place, but these guys do a good job of it.
Yeah. All right, Bruce, thank you so much for calling in with that. We are going to Patty from Texas. Patty, welcome to Dr. Radio. What is your question or comment for us?
First, I want to say, as far as we're just talking about, is there a card for organ donating? On my license, I'm in Texas, and on my license, it actually has a red heart at the bottom, and it says donor on it.
Yeah.
So
I think also I Bruce wanted to know if, like, he, since he said it's time sensitive, he didn't want them to waste time looking for his family, and he could just be like, just take them. But, you know, people.
Yeah, really.
But if they don't know their wishes, that would be the issue.
Well, there. Right. You know, there's a couple of things at issue here. So remember, most organ donations come from people who end up brain dead in a hospital. where the time sensitivity actually becomes diminished a little bit, right? Because they can keep you up on life support. Now, to Bruce's comment, and I'll come back to – I'm sorry, what's your name?
Patty.
To Bruce's comment, most organs, the heart, the lungs, basically it is a rush. It's an emergency, right? They have 4 hours essentially to get those operations done, to get that heart out of the donor and into the recipient. With a kidney, as you might have seen popularized in a couple of movies, it's different. You actually can have a kidney on ice for as much as a day or two and still be able to transplant that organ. Now, the faster it's done,
the better.
The better the chance of a better outcome. One interesting thing is that when we talk about what can be done to fix all of this, so Patty did the right thing and she registered as an organ donor, and I hope more people will do that. In this country, when there's an accident, the victims are not prepped for potential organ donation.
Are they in other countries?
Yes. There are places in Europe where every victim of an accident is prepped in case it turns out that they are an organ donor and their family approves. And that's one of the legislative changes I'm familiar with. There are groups working to effect change in areas just like this. Like, how could it possibly hurt, right? Anyone who's in a car accident who could potentially be an organ donor, prep them. Do what you can to preserve the organs. If it turns out that their family declines, okay, fine. No harm, no foul. If it turns out that their family says, yeah, we want to help some other people, you've done some things in advance to make that possible.
Yeah, that's actually the disconnect, because usually you get the brain dead person. You're not taking the person who has a life-ending injury, really, potentially life-threatening and injury that you're taking to the operating room, and you just cannot salvage the patient, which is, you cannot fix the problem. It's a done deal. And right. That is an immediate harvest situation where you would have to have, the team come in and harvest those organs immediately, which is that really is a rush, because you're in the operating room and you're trying to keep them alive, but you don't, that's a much harder situation than brain death, where the body functions like super well at times, and yet the brain is not functioning. Mm-hmm. Patty, you wanted to tell us something else, though.
Yes. I just wanted to stress to everybody listening to your show the importance that I feel of, donating to science, even, your body. My brother-in-law recently passed away from ALS, which, there's no cure for that. And he wanted his body donated to science for further research on this disease. And, without people to do that, there's, how are they going to ever find a cure for diseases that we have? So I just wanted to stress the importance of donating to science as well, so that we can, find cures for these diseases that we have no cure for.
Thank you, Patty. Thank you so much for calling in with that, because that is also critical. And congratulations to your brother-in-law and to his family for, allowing that to happen, because many times that's not what the loved ones want, So I think it's wonderful that he did that and that everybody went along with it and donated. And it's true. Like, honestly, I know it sounds so macabre that I would remember the name of the cadaver, because I think you guys were taken aback by that, right? But it's just one of those things that it is such a gift to be able to do that kind of dissection. I mean, back in the day, you look at Da Vinci, you look at these guys that did all these drawings, and I don't think they had any choice. They just were able to get access to those cadavers. It's not what we're in today, and it makes such a difference. So, and it definitely does help further science. So thank you, Patty, for calling in with that. We have like a minute. Any final thoughts there? Stu Stromwasser, Dave O'Connor.
Well, if I can, let me plug the book and invite people to please go to theorganbroker.com. And not only can you read a little bit about the novel, which is, certainly my objective. It's a thrilling, exciting story about a really interesting guy.
It's a medical thriller.
Yeah.
And it is really well written. It's a delightful read.
Thanks.
Almost Dan Brown-esque. I mean, seriously, it was really good.
He's a great writer.
Yeah.
And you can also, learn a little bit about the issues there as well. Or just go to Amazon and search The Organ Broker. I would invite people to buy the book. And again, for anyone that missed it, please do go to donatelife.net, register to be an organ donor, and I think, you know, little by little we can chip away and help, you know, to save some lives.
And have that dialogue with your family.
Definitely.
Yeah, for sure. Let them know what your wishes are. That is critical. Okay, so from the first hour, I want to thank Rachel Lisgarden, my wonderful co-host, and also Dr. David O'Connor for joining me for 2 hours. And Stu Strohmaster, author of The Organ Broker. Again, you can get it at www.theorganbroker.com and also Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And it really is incredibly well written. It's so nice that, you know, you have friends you know are talented, but then, you know, really just see different facets of that talent. It's
Thanks
quite
a
good.
Lot.
And really well researched as well. All right, I'm Dr. Marina Curry, and you're listening to Dr. Radio. We'll be back next week.
People like us, we've got to stick together. Keep your head.